The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome in, everybody, to the Sunday edition of Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennis in for Dave Schrader. Speaking of Dave, a couple of exciting things to announce on the Beyond the Darkness front and on the Dave Schrader front. One of them I don't want to spoil. I absolutely don't want to spoil, but I will tell you this. Go to Dave's social media right now. You don't know how to get there? Go to darknessradio.com and click on the links for Dave's social media. I'm going to tell you right now, I don't want to spoil it, but it's such great news on Dave's front, and I can't do it. I can't even give you a hint, but let's just say you're going to be able to see Dave on TV this fall. All the details are on his social media right now. Go check him out on Facebook. Go check him out on Twitter. Go check him out on Instagram. Get those links right now at darknessradio.com. And see where you can see Dave this fall. It's all up right now. Darknessradio.com. Click on the social media links. We'll let you know where you can see Dave this fall. Also, darknessevents.com. Michigan Paracon is coming up at the end of August. We're about a month away right now. Both Dave and I will be out there. And the lovely Mally Fox will be out there as well. It's a full Darkness Radio reunion. We've got some great stuff in store for you out there at Michigan Paracon. Everybody who's everybody is going to be out at Michigan Paracon this year. You name them, they're going to be out there. You've got people from the new Ghost Hunter show. Grant Wilson's going to be out there. You've got Nick Groff out there this year. You've got anybody who's anybody out there as far as people on television. Speaking of television, and you've got lots of paranormal experts out there this year at Michigan Paracon, the biggest Paracon in the country, and it's coming up in a little less than a month here in August. Darknessevents.com is where you want to go if you want to see where you can see Dave and I around the country. Also, we have the Chicago Ghost Conference coming up in October. You can see where you can get tickets for that by going to darknessevents.com. And of course, there's the Chris Jericho Rock and Wrestling Rager Cruise, where Dave and I are going to be there as well. You can figure out 94% sold out, by the way, for the Jericho Cruise. New guests are being added daily on the Jericho Cruise. People from AEW are being added. You've got new guests that are being added. Comedy acts, rock and roll acts. JerichoCruise.com, 94% sold out. Be sure to get your cabin now for that. I think less than 50 cabins are available for that. JerichoCruise.com or go to darknessevents.com. All the links are there. Click on them right now. And be sure to get your cabin for that. That sails in January to the Bahamas. 5-day cruise there. Be sure to join us for that. Let's jump into today's show, shall we? You know, the term conspiracy theory is kicked around quite a bit. And I love me a good conspiracy theory. This one is going to knock your socks off, folks. And we've got a great guest today joining us. Daniel Duke is the great-great-grandson of Jesse James. He grew up surrounded by stories of lost outlaw treasures. And for more than two decades, he has researched the mysteries involving his family, Freemasonry, and the Knights Templar. He lives in Texas, and today we're going to talk about Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, Secret Diaries, Coded Maps, and the Knights of the Golden Circle. Let's welcome to Beyond the Darkness, Daniel J. Duke. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. This is a very intriguing story, and I'll tell you first, let's start with a little bit of a conspiracy in itself, and that you are the great-great-grandson of Jesse James, but it didn't come easy to prove that you were the great-great-grandson of Jesse James, did it?
No, it didn't. It didn't come easy at all.
Now, the story as we know it is that Jesse James, of course, died the way he died. But that's not exactly how the story goes. Tell us how the story varies in how you found it out.
Okay. Down through the family, all the different generations from Jesse, my great-great-grandfather, his children, all the way to my mother and me. You know, when you grow up, you at family meetings and holidays and stuff, we would always hear the story that Jesse James didn't die as history stated, and that he faked his death and lived in Texas to an old age. Mm-hmm. And when you're a child, you think, well, why would my parents be wrong about that? And then you go to school, and the little bit of history we learn on those topics, they always mention, you know, Bob Ford shot and killed Jesse James in 1882. So anybody would be left wondering, who's telling the truth? You know, is history wrong, or are my parents wrong, and my grandparents and everybody else? So, from there, you know, we always wanted to know. My mother was really driven to find the truth, and she started researching long ago. She spent over 20 years researching that alone, on top of, you know, all the other family stories. But she gathered every family photo we had of Jesse and, well, you know, our Jesse. At the time, you know, we would always distinguish we called him Grandpa. It was just easier for everybody to say. Mm-hmm. When we said Grandpa, we meant Jesse. But she found his photos and photos of his mother, and those were all our family photos, and also of Frank. And we thought, okay, they look alike to us. There's a definite resemblance. No denying it to us. So, but we needed experts. And a lot of when my mother came out with her first, you know, the evidence she had in the beginning, she wanted to contact the James Farman Museum in Missouri, because she thought they would be very happy to know that Jesse didn't die as history stated.
Okay.
So she got a rude reception when she contacted them. They blew her off as, you know, we've heard this story a million times, and they were pretty rude about it. So she just went back to digging, needed more info, started reading about their, you know, the way they did things. They, like, at the time, their expert was an oil painter. And that was basically his only qualifications for photo identification. He was an oil painter. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, I can identify a photo, but we wanted people who were trained in this. So she took it to the Department of Public Safety here in Texas, which is our version of the state police. And they have a forensics lab. She took it to their forensic lab. They verified that our photos matched historically accepted photos. And she also took it to the Austin Police Department photographic forensics laboratory. They verified our photos. And the third group, at the time they were in New Jersey, they were called Visionics. They were world leaders in facial identification and facial recognition. And they ran it through all their programs and verified the same thing. So we had three highly qualified experts who we didn't pay, and they all verified that our photos matched the historically accepted photos. And even like with Jesse's mother, in our family photos of her and a known photo of her, she they were wearing the exact same dress. I mean, the same print on the dress, everything. And so it was that was our big break in this.
Okay, let me backtrack a little bit here. Now, the question, and I'm going to get slayed a little bit here by my audience if I don't ask one or two questions here in this.
Yeah.
And that is, okay, so Bob Ford supposedly shoots your grandfather and kills him in the legend and lore that we know.
Mm-hmm.
Why would Bob Ford take... Why would he take credit for this, first of all, and why would or even take the slack for it and continue to take either credit or slack for it? Because let's face it, Jesse James becomes a little bit of a folk hero in death. Why would he continue to take that type of heat or take that type of hero worship, as it were? For nothing, if Jesse decides to go underground, was there in your research, is there any type of agreement between him and your grandfather? Is there any type of monetary exchange there? Was there anything between him and your grandfather?
I believe, well, there's several theories on that, but during years ago, it was in the 90s, late 90s, early part of the 2000s, one of the Ford descendants had met my mother or contacted her, and he said in the Ford family that, you know, they have had this their legend was that Bob and Charlie helped Jesse get away with, you know, fake his death and get away with it. So, you know, we had his word, but there was no verification of that. And you have to dig and also look at other theories. So there's a lot of, that was a great question, by the way. We believe, and we've got a lot of evidence showing that Wood Height, who was Jesse's first cousin, was killed and passed off as Jesse. It wasn't planned. It just happened. The Ford boys had a sister. Her name was Martha Bolton. Martha had a farm. She lived lived on a farm. She wasn't married. There was supposedly, well, Wood Height, Jesse's cousin, He was known also as a ladies' man, mm-hmm. So he would hang around the house a lot, and Dick Liddell, who was another small gang member, and then Martha had a farmhand who also supposedly had a crush on her. Okay. So there's three men. It's kind of like a weird love triangle, and their jealousy popped up. There was a fight, and it's recorded. There was a gunfight at the house. At Martha Bolton's home, and Dick Liddell shot and killed Wood Height, and he shot him. They didn't say exactly where. I forget the details of some of the wounds on that, but Wood Height was shot and killed. They had a fight, and it was shortly before that, the date of April 3rd, 1882. You know, and it was also winter time. They buried him in a shallow grave because the ground was frozen, which also would have helped preserve the body. If you look at close up the pictures of the death photos of Jesse, mm-hmm. there's a lot of the guy who's supposed to be Jesse. There's a lot of wounds, like his hand looks messed up. His wrist looks messed up. His upper arm looks like it's had something done to it, you know, like scarred up or it's really dented looking. And then there's wounds in, it looked like old wounds on the right side of his chest. But anyway, as for Bob and Charlie, maybe there's when you go into that kind of thing, there's not a lot of verification on that. So it's hard to find any proof, but as to what they were thinking, but I know they probably wanted the reward. They also, you know, who wouldn't want the money? But I believe they also thought they would have been viewed as heroes by a large portion of the population. And I think that backfired on them. But at the same time, they could have also just been willing to help Jesse out. You know, if they viewed Jesse as the hero, like they were said to have, then as not a godlike figure, but, you know, really looked up to him, then maybe they were willing to take, you know, walk through hell for him. Some people, there's a lot of people that are like that as well. So it's kind of hard to, say what they were thinking, but I do believe it backfired on them. I mean, years later, Charlie committed suicide, and then Bob was killed in Colorado by a drunk at a saloon. So They didn't end well. Their lives didn't go well, and they had terrible reputations from what had happened or what was said to have happened. And maybe there was another theory I've often wondered about. They were there at the time. Dick Liddell was afraid that Jesse was going to kill him because Dick shot Jesse's cousin, Wood Height. So maybe the Ford boys were afraid and agreed to work with them in exchange for, you know, basically go along or we'll kill you. So maybe they didn't have much of a choice.
So basically do it out of fear rather than do it out of monetary gain.
It could be. And, you know, they were said to have been working undercover for Governor Crittenden, who was the governor of Missouri at the time. And if if it were me, especially back in those days, you've got a politician, they can get a lot done. But at the same time, you've got a politician on one side who can get a lot done and have things done in the shadows if they wanted to. Or you go against Jesse, who didn't have any limitations holding him back other than just don't get caught. So, you know, who would you be more afraid of in a situation like that? The governor or Jesse and a large gang of people?
There's something in I want to get to this in a minute because there's an interesting turn here to the story that I want to address too. But in the exhumation of the body, and let's get to that here first. Well, no, you know what? Let's talk about the turn here first, and then we'll get to the exhumation of the body.
Okay.
The turn here, and this is kind of the angle that I'm wondering about too. When we talk about why Bob Ford's motives and why he would do this, why he would go along with the conspiracy of Jesse James and faking his death. It occurs to me too that would it be because Jesse made some sort of an agreement with a law enforcement agency to give up his life of crime and in exchange go straight, because he wouldn't make an agreement to go to jail? Because it seems to me, or you know, at the time. And this may seem, you know, I may be getting a lot of eyes rolling in the audience right now, but it seems to me, like you said, Jesse pretty much had run of the land. Nobody could catch him. Nobody could jail him. Nobody could. And he certainly wasn't going to stand still long enough to be hung.
That's true.
Do you think that, or in your research, was there anything out there suggesting that maybe somebody had made a deal, like you had mentioned, there was a governor involved, that somebody had maybe potentially made a deal where they said, Jesse, you know, if you just go straight, we'll call off the dogs?
That could have been. I always keep an open mind on any theories out there, because there are a lot of holes in the story that we have no proof of. There's no papers or anything to follow. So that could have very well been. I have found evidence to show it's not really strong evidence at all. And it's hard to find it, but there have been others who were involved in it on the law side of the story who retired and moved away to really nice homes afterwards. And back then, you know, police officers don't get paid that much, especially back then. They didn't get paid large salaries enough to buy really nice homes on the coast. And that's as much as I can say about that right now.
Okay.
But yeah, one of the guys who was heavily involved in this that did exactly that. As soon as shortly, like a month or two later, he retired and moved to the coast, and his house is still a tourist spot today.
Very interesting. One of the things that struck me as I'm reading the book is that it seems like Jesse might have had a little more money, a little more treasure, a little more gold than what we've heard about as far as the targets that Jesse had robbed. Do you think that Jesse was on to bigger targets than just bank robberies or you know, payroll robberies or something to that effect? Do you think he actually had dug up bigger targets?
I don't know if he recovered any treasures, but I know he, you're exactly right. There's a lot more. He's buried a lot more than I think he could have robbed from a train or a bank. I know some train cargoes of gold coming from the West, like out from California and heading back East. Some of those, they could have held a lot of gold. But at the same time, that would have hampered any quick getaway. They would have had to have buried it really close to the site of the robbery to get away by the time people showed up. So, yeah, there's a lot of, for example, one robbery they did was, it's got different legends. Some say he robbed, it was a 40 mule train, like 40 mules, a mule train, all of them packing up between 75 and 150 pounds of gold. You know, so 150 times 40 or 75 times 40, that's quite a bit of gold. And it was supposed to have been gold coins in one story. Another said it was placer gold. But some attribute it to it was a union, like the U.S. Army was supposedly transporting it across New Mexico and you know, for paying troops in different areas. Another legend claims that it was a Mexican gold train, you know, operated by the Mexican government. But anyway, that treasure was supposed to have been stolen and buried, and the location it was said to have been buried is also on the treasure templates that I discovered. So, but I'll talk about, I don't want to get ahead of myself on that.
Sure.
But
sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of legends. I think you're right. He seemed to have had a lot more than could have been accounted for from train and bank robberies.
If you had to estimate it, how much do you think your great-great-grandfather was worth before the end of his life?
Oh, God. In today's value, he would have been a millionaire easy. We have one eyewitness account, George Roman. He was a former Freemason and a Shriner. He was old when we met him. He told us when he was around 10 years old, he knew Jesse when Jesse was old, because Jesse died in 1943 at the age of 97. Well, George knew Jesse. Jesse swore him to secrecy, and you know they'd buried the treasure together. But Jesse hired him to help him move some gold bars. But another story, and he wrote that down in front of a notary public, an affidavit. He left behind the affidavit stating that one time he was with one of Jesse's sons. They walked into the barn and there was 30 ingots of gold, each one weighing 15 pounds each, you know, a piece. Mm-hmm. And that alone is worth a fortune today. So he would have easily been a millionaire, in my opinion.
Okay.
And he paid for everything in cash or gold, you know, back in those days.
Wow. let's move to the exhumation of the body and the DNA evidence of the body that was sitting in, I believe it was Kearney, Nebraska, right?
Yeah.
Now,
Kearney, Missouri. Sorry,
Kearney, Missouri. Sorry.
And actually, the picture was taken. The killing took place in St. Joseph, Missouri,
right,
which is north of Kearney.
Okay, so Kearney, Missouri. They pull up this body, and I believe it was in the 90s. Correct.
Yes, 1995.
Right, 1995. And I believe at the time they took a hair sample, and they also tried to get DNA off of a tooth.
Yes.
Now, there was an issue with the hair sample, and I know you write about the hair sample specifically in the book. Can you tell me a little bit about the hair sample and what was wrong with the hair sample?
Okay. You know, they first of all, they hired the guy they had heading the exhumation wasn't even a forensics. He wasn't a doctor. He wasn't a forensics expert. He was a law professor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just a law professor. And if you're going to do something like that, you'd think I would want a doctor who specialized in that field. But anyway, they dug up the grave and they didn't, they found a woman's bones, some women's clothes, and another skeleton mixed to several people, at least two different people in the grave. They couldn't retrieve any DNA from that, so they got a court order to retrieve to test a tooth and a sample of what was said to have been Jesse's hair from the James Farman Museum. So they had an attorney who at the time, actually, he's an attorney, but at the time he was Clay County Commissioner, Stephen Caruso. And Stephen Caruso didn't like anything about the exhumation and how it was being conducted. He described it as a tawdry sideshow. So he went, he didn't like it. They ordered him to give the sample of the hair and the tooth over, you know, hand it over. So Caruso pulled the hair out of his friend's head, who was John Hartman. At the time, he was the Clay County Parks Director. Pulled the hair out of John Hartman's head and submitted that instead of the hair that was supposed to have been Jesse's hair. And they tested that. And on their documentaries, they mentioned the hair and said, well, while we didn't get DNA from the hair, everything else about the hair sample falls in line with our records of, you know, of Jesse and using hair dye. that really made Stephen Caruso laugh hard. He was laughing when he told my mother and I when we met him. But the tooth they tested was found in 1978 in the yard at the James Farm. Somebody was digging. They weren't even an archaeologist. It was people connected with the James Farm digging up areas of the James Farm, and they dug up a tooth, a human tooth, a hog's tooth, a dog's tooth, and some other animal bones. And they were said to have found other bones, and over the years, the curator of the museum at the time would pass the bones out to friends and other people. Instead of preserving them, he would pass them out. He kept the tooth in a Tupperware bowl. It had been passed around, showed around. People had touched it, so it was contaminated. And the main thing on that, they hang everything they have on that 1909 exhumation as proof that Jesse died as history stated he did, yet they have no proof. They can't prove where the tooth came from. They can't prove who it belonged to, and there's no chain of custody. Nothing about it was done professionally or scientifically, so they have nothing.
Even when you do Google searches of Jesse James DNA, even, and I'll tell this just for our audience, even if you're doubting what Dan is saying here, just do a Google search of Jesse James and the DNA sequences, and there's not an article out there really that says profoundly or definitively that any of the tooth DNA or the hair DNA is that of Jesse James, which is interesting. There's a lot of doubt out there as to the actual DNA that came out of that grave, which definitely kind of raises some suspicion. So you have these pictures that have been looked at by state authorities, and you have suspicious DNA tests, and you have George Roaming, I believe you said it was, that said, yeah, this is definitely Jesse, and I've worked with Jesse. You had some other people that had run with Jesse, didn't you? That said when they saw the pictures of Jesse that yeah, this is definitely Jesse.
Yeah, throughout the years there were a lot of people. One guy in particular, he claimed to be Jesse James at one time. You know, as I'd mentioned, Jesse died in 1943 at the age of 97. Well, 5 years after that, in 1948, an old man came out publicly saying, "I'm Jesse James. I'm the real Jesse." And his name was J. Frank Dalton. And he'd been debunked thoroughly many times on his claims as being Jesse, but he obviously knew a lot. My great-grandmother had taken, for example, before he came out claiming he was Jesse, my great-grandmother lived in Marble Falls, Texas. And that was Jesse's daughter, Ida. She lived in Marble Falls, Texas. And right across the street was a hotel. Well, J. Frank Dalton came by and stayed in the hotel for a couple of weeks, and he would always talk to her. He kept purposely trying to strike up conversations, and he got to know her. They got to talking, and then after he left, she didn't hear anything of him. Some of her papers were missing, according to family legend, after he had left, which made, you know, that's, I think he was after some of the treasure stuff. But anyway, he got sick. After he came out saying he was Jesse, he got sick. He was in the hospital in Austin. So my grandmother took her photo, you know, photos that she had, and said, "Are you Jesse or is he Jesse?" And he pointed at the picture and said, "That is Jesse. Your father was Jesse James." And I think he had been having a lot of hard times, And I can't really condemn him for what he did, you know, J. Frank Dalton. But at the same, you know, he was having very hard times. He was poor, wasn't eating right. He was sick. And I think he came out with that. So in hopes that he could make a few bucks and, you know, die at least with a full stomach. So.
And I get that. I mean, the search for fame that would, you know, the what would come about if he could say he was Jesse James and, you know, and what he could pursue if you know, he did do the media tour. And you know, I guess I kind of get that. But you would think that there would still be people around at that time that could say, well, you know what, you're not Jesse.
Yeah. There were people who did that, too. He would go from town to town claiming it. And, you know, the guy who was with him was kind of like his manager. There's a lot of weird stories involving his manager, like being abusive and stuff. But J. Frank Dalton would get on a stage and start telling, you know, this story. And somebody would usually someone would show up in the crowd and say, I knew Jesse and you're not him. And J. Frank Dalton would leave fairly quickly. So it was a lot of funny stories. It reminded me of those old snake oil salesmen that you see on old movies.
Well, folks, Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. You won't see any fake Jesse Jameses on there. Watch over 100 television channels and thousands of movies on demand, all completely free. Pluto TV never asks you for a credit card. You don't even need to sign up to watch free. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies for free. What are you waiting for? You never pay for TV again by downloading Pluto TV. You can download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today, including your phone, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, and I have Pluto TV on all my Apple TVs, on all of my televisions, smart TVs, PlayStation, and anywhere else you stream. Pluto TV is a leading free streaming television service. Watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed, no sign up. Pluto TV is easy and completely legal way to watch your free TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? By gosh, never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today. We're talking with Daniel J. Duke. He is the author of the new book, Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, Secret Diaries, Coded Maps, and the Knights of the Golden Circle. And we were talking about his great-great-grandfather, who is, I don't want to say purported to be Jesse James because everything points to him being Jesse James, but his name in later life, go ahead and tell him what he was known as in later life, Dan.
The name he lived under was James Lafayette Courtney, and on his tombstone it says J.L. Courtney. He was, you know, people called him J.L., James L., or just James Lafayette Courtney. And the Courtney man was actually the real James Lafayette Courtney was a Union bugler in the Civil War. Didn't even fight for the same side, but they were cousins. And after he had taken his name in 1871, 11 years before he would use it before he faked his death. But they were cousins. After he'd moved to Texas, it's hard to find any record. I traced the original James L. Courtney down. Their descriptions didn't match. They had, you know, James L. Courtney had black hair. Jesse didn't have black hair. He had sandy colored hair.
Okay.
And their height was off. Jesse was a tall man. And the real James L. Courtney was an average height. Then you know, there's a lot of discrepancies on that. Their descriptions don't match up at all. And then James L. Courtney, I tracked him in census records and marriage records. He married a lady in Kansas, and that's the last he's ever seen or heard of. There's no record of him anywhere. It's like he dropped off the face of the earth. And I don't know if somebody killed him or if he maybe he changed his name. Because several of the Courtney family who were supposed, you know, they thought they were Courtneys. They found out later their original name was Andrus and they changed it to Courtney.
Really?
They were all mixed in together with, they were related to Jesse and they lived in the same area during the Civil War.
Interesting. Now,
yeah.
Now is it did he directly take that name from that J.L. Courtney, or was it just an alias that happened to be, he took, you know, he happened to take that alias, and it was just, you know, coincidence that he had taken that name, and there were two people with that same name. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand. And that's a good question. That's another mystery that needs to be, I would like to solve. As you know, they didn't write it down that they did this, but at the same time, well, like there's a poem in his diary from 1871 to 1876. He wrote a little, it wasn't even a poem. It was just a quick little jingle. It said, "When Stillman triced, J.L. Courtney is my heist." And then on another page, he signed it J. James. So, you know, you've got that in a diary. And then it's just that there's a lot of strange things. He signed his name J. James. He mentions, that's basically, he's admitting he took the name James L. Courtney. J. L. Courtney is my heist. Hmm. And I thought, you know, who else would talk like that other than a robber? That's his heist. So,
right. Yeah.
You know, he wrote that. And then there's a lot of, I think the real J.L. Courtney knew, I think they agreed to it. And I also think that's why he falls off the face of the earth on, you know, there's no more paper trail after his wedding.
Wow. No more paper trail after his wedding, huh?
That's right.
Interesting.
I have yet to find anything after his wedding showing anything about him. No death record or anything.
So, I wonder how do you cover that up?
Well, back then it wasn't too hard to. I mean, you know, we didn't have all the numbers and ID and cameras everywhere. It was all you had to do was move and tell everybody a different name, come up with a name you wanted to live with. And just tell people that's who you are.
Well, now, I get that much. And I know that, you know, records aren't back then what they are today. Which brings up my next question. And that is this. In the book, you cite that when your great-grandfather changed his name to J.L. Courtney and and moved to Texas, because that was the next move, was he moved to Texas. He became a Freemason.
That's true.
Now I have this question for you, and I'm going to set this up a little bit. Here's a man who led a life of crime, didn't necessarily live an honest and straightforward life. And, one of the requirements for being a Freemason is that you be an upstanding citizen.
That's true.
And one of the things about being a Freemason is that they do tend to look into your background and tend to do quite a thorough background check on you. And weren't there quite a few wanted posters out there with Jesse James' mug on them? I mean,
true.
How did he get through the voting process to become a Freemason?
Well, that's a great question. There, when he came to Texas, you know, he lived under the alias of James Lafayette Courtney, and he lived a peaceful life. He low key, low profile. He didn't go around, you know, he didn't go into town living it up at the saloons. He lived as a farmer, and his father-in-law, he married the daughter of Captain Thomas Hudson Barron. He was a Texas Ranger. He's buried at the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame and Museum in Waco, Texas. He's buried in a cemetery that's next to the Ranger Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. But there's no record that Thomas Barron was a Mason. So, you know, that kind of counts that out. I thought, well, maybe Thomas Barron had some pull and that's how he got in. That counts that out. So, I know for a fact he was a Freemason here in Texas. That's, you know, on record in the lodges. And all the guys at the lodge that he went to, they claim that he was Jesse. They know he was Jesse, and, you know, they're proud to be a member of that lodge. So, you know, it's a neat piece of history. But at the same time, you know, looking for proof on that, when you mentioned his mug was all over the place, a likeness of him, and they didn't, even the Pinkerton Detective Agency, who were well known, you know, they were very famous back then for putting an end to a lot of gangs and different outlaws. They had no idea what he looked like. Nobody could ID Jesse other than his family, his immediate family, and his, you know, the guys who rode with him. So it was a small group of men who rode with him. They were all loyal to each other and his immediate family who, were, you know, they would have stood by him, stood with him to the death. So, there, you know, a lot of people ask that question. And I'm glad you asked that because nobody had an idea of him. And that's also how they helped, you know, pass Wood Height, his cousin, off as Jesse, because Wood Height also bore a strong resemblance to him. So he matched the likeness and it was easy to you know, after 1882, but between 1871 and 1882, he lived low profile and nobody had an accurate description of him.
Interesting.
As for the Masons, I don't think, you know, and I agree, that's very, they do a very thorough background search. So, you know, if he's going under the name James Lafayette Courtney and living as a, he even collected a Union pension when he was older. So under the name James Lafayette Courtney. So he was living the life and he had all the records to back it all up. So there wasn't any reason to doubt that name if he wasn't committing crimes and running around crazy. So
I just find that intriguing that, you know, I mean, the whole idea behind being a Freemason is that you're an upstanding citizen and that you just passed the.
And also, he wasn't an angel by any means, but he wasn't the bad, bloodthirsty killer a lot of people have painted him to be. Okay. You know, he was also known as America's Robin Hood by half the country. So, you know, the country was divided. They'd just come through a bitter civil war, Freemasons on both sides. It was just, you know, different people, including Freemasons on both sides of the war. It was, I'm starting to forget the point I was trying to make.
I think I know where you're going, that basically everybody kind of had a little bit of dirt on them.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. And also, when he became an outlaw, you know, at the beginning of the Civil War, he was 14 years old. He was too young to fight in a legitimate Confederacy. Mm-hmm. So, and he was beat brutally by some Kansas Jayhawkers.
They also
pushed his mother around who was pregnant. They whipped her, or it's said by some sources that she was whipped, tied to a tree and whipped. And then they hung his stepfather, didn't kill him, but he had brain damage. So he wanted revenge. That was his whole reason for fighting to begin with. Mm-hmm. He couldn't join the normal army, but Quantrill's guerrillas was more than happy to take him because he was a very deadly shot. So they took him. He got his training. At the end of the war, when the rest of the Confederate Army was granted amnesty, regular soldiers, the guerrillas were denied amnesty. So they were hunted. If they were caught, captured, or turned themselves in, they were executed. And he tried to turn himself in 1865 and got a bullet through his chest for his efforts. So somehow he escaped that and lived. And you know, it was, in a way, it was either leave the country or live up to your outlaw name. And being young at that age, you know how teenage boys are, and even up to their, for me, it was in my 30s. You kind of think you're invincible and nothing's going to happen, and you're a little more hot-headed in some way. So I'm sure he wasn't an angel. He made a lot of mistakes, but he wasn't the crazy killer that a lot of people paint him out to be.
Understandable. Well, let's do this. Let's take a break, Dan, and when we come back, let's talk a little bit about not only Jesse's treasure, but the fact that when you started looking into Jesse's treasure, you ran into some other treasure, and that led to treasure maps and how to craft these treasure maps and a different type of treasure map altogether, and it all becomes one big conspiracy that leads to different groups that we've been talking about, the Freemasons, the Knights Templar, and many other different conspiracies. It all becomes one big, it seems like a big jumbled mess, but we'll untangle it and unpack it for you, and it becomes quite the story and quite an intriguing story at that. Our guest is Daniel J. Duke. The book is Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, Secret Diaries, Coded Maps, and the Knights of the Golden Circle. When we come back, more about Jesse James and more about treasure maps when we come back on Beyond the Darkness.
Calling all true crime fans, the Court Junkie Podcast is now on Podcast One. Imagine being wrongfully convicted for a crime you didn't commit, or a killer is still on the loose, even though there's enough evidence for an arrest, the Court Junkie podcast shines a light on the injustices of the judicial system with deep dives into court documents and interviews with those closest to the case. Download new episodes of Court Junkie podcast on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? Get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get the answers you need, so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader. Our guest is Daniel J. Duke. The book is Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, Secret Diaries, Coded Maps, and the Knights of the Golden Circle. And in the last segment, we were talking about Dan's great-great-grandfather, Jesse James, otherwise known as J.L. Courtney. That's the name he took after he faked his death. And we were talking about in the first segment some of what J.L. Courtney had stashed away in hidden treasure on his own. And I believe George Roeming, you said, was the name of the person who had worked with him towards the end of his life, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And George had said, in one of the more compelling stories in the book, you had said that George had helped him. I'm trying to remember the amount of gold you had said he had helped him stash away.
It was 680 bars of gold.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, in that, when he had helped him stash that gold away, and I want you to tell this story, Dan. He had put it in a location, and didn't he take you out to this location at one point?
Well, George was sick, and he told my mother, me and my mother, the story. He was real sick. He was out in El Paso at the time. He was in the hospital and he asked us to please come see him. And, you know, we were going to, but he wanted us to show up earlier than expected. And we got there, and he said, just in case he didn't make it, he thought he would, and he did make it that time. You know, he wanted us to know the story and what, you know, where it was. So he told us the story when he was, you know, 10 years old. He helped Jesse hired him and swore him to an oath to go out. This was also about 20 miles from Jesse's home, but he wanted him to move the gold with him in a large, they called it a dray. It's a large wagon for carrying heavy freights. But they took the gold out to this area where Jesse knew some other men about his age. They were also old, and they dug a hole. They had a hole that was 8 foot deep, lined with timbers on the bottom. They buried the gold, and George drew the map for us, letting us know exactly where it was.
And this map brought you to a place that, well, at the time it was a plot of land, obviously, where they buried this gold. What is it
That's
now?
That's right. Oh, yeah. We got out there. Well, he told us, go find it. I want to know if it's there. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, more than happy, we went out there. And, well, we headed out there. We never got to it. It's under the lake. It's under a lake, and it's on Fort Hood military, reservation. It's on the military base, Fort Hood, which is the large, I believe it's still the largest army base in the U.S. So I thought, yeah, there's no way we're going to go there.
Yeah, I don't think they're letting you on the base to get that anytime soon. Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, and it was also under the lake. And I don't know if it was moved if someone had moved it before the lake was created, or if or I don't know, it could still be there if it's meant to be if they wanted to just store it for no telling what, that's the best place to put it. So
it's a good question. That brings me back to a topic earlier in the book. You mentioned, and I'm trying to remember the name of the cave in New Mexico.
Victoria Peak.
Right, Victoria Peak, and that was even mentioned in the Watergate hearings, and I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name.
Doc Noss.
Yes, Doc Noss, who had stumbled across this, had discovered all of that treasure, had dynamited the thing, unfortunately. Yeah. had pulled out quite a bit of treasure, and hadn't his wife kept going back after he had left her? Is that how the story goes?
Yeah. Doc Noss was the little bit that's written about him. He was looking for, he was supposedly hunting, deer or antelope, and stumbled onto this. And then, when he found it, at the time it was illegal for people in America to own gold. So he couldn't own the gold legally, and when he discovered that it was gold, he kept going back down in there and getting more and more. And then they say that he grew more and more paranoid over the years. He was dealing with black market people, and that's not a safe area to be around anyway. Mm-hmm. So he ended up getting shot in the back of the head. But he was so paranoid before his death, he even left his wife. He left his wife. He couldn't keep any of his friends. He didn't trust anybody. Ran off, married another lady, and then it's just like he went downhill real quick after that, and he ended up shot in the back of the head by one of his business partners. His wife, whose name was, they called her Babe. Babe kept going back for years. She fought the government. She got lawyers, and they finally got permission to go and look, but they were said to have not, it was supposedly empty when she got there.
Wow. And now the military gets into this, because there's a couple of military guys who stumble across Victoria Peak, don't they?
Yeah, they were looking for it, and they had supposedly found some, and they got permission to go back, but they had blasted the entrance that they found. They said they blasted the entrance shut so nobody else could find it. And I guess they thought it would be easy enough to get back in there, but they were denied permission eventually to return to Victoria Peak. And they had seen treasures. They were given polygraph tests by the Secret Service, and I believe it was the Air Force. And they passed all their tests, all the polygraph tests, they were obviously telling the truth about what they had seen. And, but they were denied access. So,
and I think eventually, even if they had gotten back there to Victoria Peak, the military probably cleaned out whatever was left in there.
That's my feelings. I think they took it for whatever use they had for it. So, but I believe you're exactly right.
Yeah. Now, when you were talking with George, and talking about this treasure that was sitting over in Fort Hood, eventually you came across a template of a map, didn't you?
Yes, I did. When George's map was the final key I needed. With this template and the way it's designed, you have to have, for me anyway, I had to have at least, two or three known sites to go by so that I could determine what the scale of the template would be. And around the same time, it was a little prior to meeting George, my mother had been talking a lot with former Attorney General of the state of Texas, Wagner Carr. And he was really interested in Jesse and all the stories. He used to believe the J. Frank Dalton story until he spoke with my mom, and she convinced him, after speaking with her and seeing her evidence, he decided the J. Frank Dalton thing was wrong, and he believed our story. So he sent his driver to show me and my mother where the two other large catches were supposedly recovered. And And I had no reason to doubt it. And everything every way they described it fit exactly when we got there. You know, the one site had a railroad trestle, a spur of the railroad had been built off to the side. And it was just a real short spur, but that's where they were said to have buried one. And there was a large depression, the depression that was left in the ground was large enough to hide a house in. Mm. And now it's used as a stock tank for cattle. Mm-hmm. But the other one was down in a cave. It's just 12 miles from me. It was down in a cave, and the cave was filled in after the treasure was recovered. So using those two locations, and in addition to George's location, is what gave me the scale and dimensions of one of the templates.
So you've got this template in front of you, and you kind of figure out to yourself how to negotiate this treasure map. And how do you apply this template to finding other treasure? How do you make the jump?
All right. Well, I laid the template over, you know, when I was working with it. I made a transparency, and I used Google Earth to get that, you know, it was real easy doing it that way instead of trying to splice a bunch of topographic maps together. That would have taken every wall in the house. Okay. So I used Google Earth, and I played with the template, and I finally got it just everything fell in place. It looked right. I double checked it. The center of that particular template was right on my great-great-grandfather's property. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, and it also lined up with other places we had suspected the areas, but it helped pinpoint it. So I thought, okay, I've got that. And while I was playing around with it, I thought, I wonder if it expands. And so I started setting templates next to other, you know, next to the original template, and I just covered most of the state of Texas. It lined up with other treasure sites that I'd heard legends of, also historical sites. And as I expanded it, I kept going as far as I could, you know, for a long time, and it'll kill your eyes doing this, but I was driven to see how far it went. Well, it lined up with historical sites around the nation, places like the Newport Tower, places like the Kensington Runestone, that Scott Wolter had worked on so much. Mm-hmm. And also the Los Lunas Decalogue Stone in New Mexico. And it also lined up with, you know, places, a lot of other known treasure locations where treasures had been recovered.
Very interesting. So at this point, this template is pointing you out to different historical sites. And does the light go on at this point? And you go, well, wait a minute, if it's reaching out to all these different historical places, then there's got to be something bigger than just my great-grandfather here. At what point do you start to think what historical groups are behind this? Do you automatically flash to one group, many groups? Where does your mind go?
Okay. At first I thought, you know, I believed, I had no reason to doubt the story about the Knights of the Golden Circle. They were, you know, a secretive organization in the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. Their whole goal during the Civil War was to slow or halt Union movements and burn bridges and things like that. And then after the Civil War was over, just like, you know, anybody on the losing side, they're going to feel, a lot of them are going to want to fight again or something like that. So I had no reason to disbelieve that their new goal after the Civil War was to get as much wealth as they could any way they could so that they could refund a second Civil War.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, that kind of makes sense. And in those circles that get deep into the Knights of the Golden Circle, I found out, you know, I'd hear about Victoria Peak all the time. Mm-hmm. and all these other sites. And I thought, okay, well, if Victoria Peak is involved in this, I need to research that. Maybe it'll help me out. And you know, I had questions. I knew my great great grandfather was a Freemason while he was in Texas, mm-hmm. but I didn't connect any of those dots at the time. I started looking into Victoria Peak, and I thought, okay, you know, there's a lot of things about Victoria Peak, including the treasures that were buried there, are said to have been buried there. And not only the treasures, but also a letter that was dated from 1797. And the letter alone predates the KGC completely, you know, the Knights of the Golden Circle.
Right.
So I thought, okay, so that kind of, that seems strange. And a lot of other things started falling, started coming, you know, coming into light that discounted the involvement of the Knights of the Golden Circle. So I had also heard around the same time the story about Williamsburg, Virginia. And there's a vault, a treasure legend involving that town. It's called the Bruton Vault. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the church in town is the Bruton Parish Church. And that's one of the there's so many different things I was reading at the same time and research. It was kind of like, you know, when I go back and look at those days, it reminds me of trying to stare into a whirlwind and find out exactly what I was doing. I was doing so much, staying up all hours of the night. But Bruton Parish Church led me to Marie Bauer. And Marie Bauer later married Manly Palmer Hall. She had written a book titled Foundations Unearthed about the treasures, alleged treasure at the Bruton Vault. And all the different coded messages from Francis Bacon and people around him, that, and also encoded messages, suppose anagrams on headstones in a cemetery at the Bruton Parish Church. Mm-hmm. She decoded these and located people. People didn't believe her at first, but she decrypted these messages and anagrams and located the original foundations of the Bruton Parish Church, which they said, you know, the experts said didn't exist. And she proved them wrong. And then she also went further and said that there's a vault beneath the cemetery that is full of treasures of great spiritual and historical wealth. And I, you know, just seeing that little bit about it, I thought, wow, that's, you know, it amazed me. It tied in Manly Palmer Hall, and I started to wonder, you know, do the Freemasons, could this be from Freemasons? I've discounted the KGC. Okay. Could it be a Freemasonic treasure?
Okay.
And that's when it led in. I started reading as much as I could from Albert Pike, Manly Palmer Hall, and Timothy Hogan's books, a lot of different people's books, you know, who had ties with Freemasonry. And that's when, like, especially Albert Pike, he mentions Kabbalah throughout, like Morals and Dogma. All throughout the book, he mentions Kabbalah, and it kept popping up. And I thought, maybe I need, you know, there was a lot of hints in my mind that I needed to take that path and start learning as much as I could about Kabbalah. And then when I did, I started tying in the numbers that are involved in, like, distances and dimensions with the template that I'd discovered, or that I'd figured out, and it all seemed to tie in perfectly. And also, I don't want to leave out the Tree of Life template.
Sure.
Which runs, the center pillar of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life on the map runs from Bruton Parish Church to Victoria Peak. And other known treasure sites, like the one that's 12 miles from me that I mentioned earlier that was down in a cave, that's also on the Tree of Life template. It formed the shape of a tree of life. And I thought, how can these two templates work together? You know, there's this one template that looks like a square with circles, and then here's the new one. Are these two separate treasures, or do they tie in? And as I was going, you know, I continued researching Kabbalah, Jewish, Christian, and occult Kabbalah, and other books written by Freemasons and people associated with Freemasonry, and everything started to fall into place. The distances, the gematria of the distances, had a, you know, tied in the meanings of the gematria, tied in with the Tree of Life and the veil and all the other symbols. It felt like I was getting torn into 10 different directions, mm-hmm. but it would all point right back into the same goal I had. It's hard to describe the feelings that I went through when I was doing it. You know, you feel bewildered, amazed, and so many other emotions all at the same time. It's kind of, there's times when you literally, or I did anyway, I thought, am I going insane?
Right. And and to clarify for our audience, when you're looking at this, at the initial map that you received from George, geometrically, when you look at it, it kind of blows your mind because you don't know what you're looking at. But then you take that template and it looks, you know, it looks like you're kind of looking almost like at a spider web, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And it's got different things inside the spider web. And to take that and you're thinking, well, what exactly am I looking at? But then when you break it down geometrically and then you figure out what exactly the length, like you were saying, what exactly the lengths are in between. And then you figure out, and like you were saying, you take those numbers and you break down when you're talking about the Kabbalah. And every letter in the, like you were saying, in Hebrew, every letter has a numeric meaning.
That's right.
So there's quite a bit of math here, folks. And I know some of us with math hurts our heads. but so you actually have to translate numbers back into letters to figure out what things mean. And that's what the code is to breaking some of this treasure and figuring out where things are. It just in layman's terms, that's essentially what things mean. Right, Dan?
That's right. You described that perfectly.
So in this, when you're trying to figure out what exactly all this means, you're breaking down and you're finding out throughout your journey with the different templates. And you're not just finding one template. It essentially, you start out with your great-grandfather's template, but one becomes another, doesn't it?
It does.
So you start
like a big. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're fine. You're fine. So you started out initially with your great grandfather's template, but then you had a KGC template, right?
That's right. I thought it was KGC, and then after all the different findings and known sites like Victoria Peak, for example, I discounted the KGC involvement because all this stuff predated the KGC by centuries.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, and I was just going to add that, and I never did any of this overnight. It took years and years. Things slowly. Sometimes things would flood in, and it would piece together. It was like a flood of information. Then it would slow down. I'd have to take a break just to clear my head, and then you'd come back to it. And it was like I kept having to walk away and then come back to it. And each time I came back, I'd have more with me, and it just, the pieces would start falling in place again. And I let it from, you know, I could, after discounting the KGC's involvement, that's when it started pointing more towards Freemasonry.
What's interesting is as you're doing these templates and really what's, I have to encourage our audience to you know, normally you hear, well, go pick up the book, and people kind of roll their eyes and, oh, yeah, go pick up the book. But seriously, go pick up the book because you have to see some of these diagrams. And again, the book is Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, Secret Diaries, Coded Maps, and the Knights of the Golden Circle. As I'm thumbing through the book, the most intriguing diagram or map in the book is the diagram of the Tree of Life overlaid on the North American portion of a world map. And when we talk about the Tree of Life, In Kabbalah, you're talking about the diagram of all that is. So the diagram of everything that is life. But essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Dan, the map that you have drawn out here on North America, which is essentially the Tree of Life over North America, is the map of all the treasure that exists in North America. But in itself is a complex map because there are spiritual treasure that is buried in this map. And there is, so spiritual treasure, meaning there is knowledge or knowledge treasure, like scripts, texts, maybe even what I dare to say, a Holy Grail. Or do you think the Holy Grail is buried in America?
It could be, and what I don't know what form it takes, but it could very well be buried in America, North America.
Or maybe even religious relics of some sort buried in America. And then you have literal treasure, like gold, silver, things of monetary value. And in what I'm counting here, there are probably, how many would you say, treasure points in this tree of life?
In the tree of life, that's a good question, because I've, you know, it's commonly, they commonly say there are 10 Sephiroth, sorry about that, my throat.
No, you're
fine. I had to clear it.
Yep.
But anyway, there's 10 spots on the tree of life. And I hear the each spot pronounced differently from different people, so it leaves me wondering if I'm saying it correctly each time I say it. But mm-hmm. 10 Sephira or Sephiroth on the tree of life, they've been explained as by one rabbi. I had read one of his books. He had described them as vessels of light, and I always liked that. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier for me to pronounce. Also, having a Texas accent, I think everybody knows we have a hard time pronouncing some words. So.
We have a tough time up north here too, so don't feel bad about it.
But they, I think there's 10, but there's also a hidden Sephira or vessel of light known as Daath. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, mm-hmm. but that's, it symbolizes the abyss or knowledge. And I don't know if that too would include one. I've been wondering about that a lot lately. If the hidden Sephira or Sephiroth contain, if that's included, are there 10 or are there 11
okay.
on the tree of life? And then with the veil covers the Americas, North America, Canada, or the United States, Canada, and Mexico.
Okay. Now, one of the interesting things in the book here, too, is and when you look at this tree of life overlay, it does extend as far, you know, North America as Canada, or it looks like it goes up as far north as Canada, as far south as maybe even is that Texas or as far south as maybe even Mexico?
Yeah, it's in on the tree of life, that template, it goes as far south as Texas.
Okay. And it goes all the way, it looks like it maybe even extend west into California?
That was, I believe, is the westernmost point of the Tree of Life template is in New Mexico at Victoria Peak.
Okay, at Victoria Peak. Okay, mm-hmm. So then the other thing that's intriguing is you do make mention when we talk about Arcadia, and I'm gonna skip ahead to Arcadia a little bit. You make mention of Oak Island in your book as well, mm-hmm. in the Arcadian Shepherds, and I want to bring this up a little bit because there's been, you know, of course we've had the Oak Island TV show, and you've had a lot of money put into Oak Island recently on television trying to find treasure up there.
Yeah.
And it's been well known that there have been some lives lost up there trying to find treasure up there. It seems to me that in at least in the television series, there hasn't been a lot found up there.
I agree. Yeah, I think maybe they found one coin or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And some artifacts.
Yep. Yeah, but it seems like that, at least in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, I don't know anything for sure or anything like that, it seems like that might have been either moved or someone had found it already and absconded with it.
I agree. I've thought that a lot. That's a very interesting story. I believe there's a lot of evidence to show that something was there, but I do think my theory on that, and I have no proof, you know, I'm not 100%, but my theory on that is that they used that as a staging area. When they first came over, you know, when they brought the treasures over, I think that was the first place they came to. And, you know, it was a good place to hide it. I think they hid it, but I think it may have been moved. I think it was moved over time.
So is the Arcadia section of this different than the Tree of Life, or is it involved in the Tree of Life overlay?
I believe it's involved in it as well. That's where the writings of Peter Dawkins, He's a Rosicrucian. Those came into play, and that's where I stumbled onto some of the information. A lot of the information about Arcadia was first from reading Peter Dawkins' essays, and he has two or three of them specifically about Oak Island. He had mentioned the constellation Cygnus, which is, you know, the shape of a swan, mm-hmm. and that eventually, after seeing that, there's so many topics that led me to. I'm trying to make sure I stay on topic with your question.
Sure, no, I understand. Yeah.
Cygnus, all his writings about Cygnus, Oak Island, and Arcadia got me into researching more about Arcadia, and I am so thankful for that because he posted those articles because it led me to several major clues that helped verify the Tree of Life template. So yes, they do connect.
Okay. I am jumping around a little bit, and I guess the reason I'm jumping around a little bit is I'm trying to simplify as much as I can.
It wasn't you at all. It was me. I have a tendency to, when I'm talking, there's so many, you know, as with this research, there's so many side topics I can go off onto, and I have to force myself to stay on topic. So.
Oh, and feel free. if there's a side topic you want to touch on, feel free to touch on it. We talk about, and I want to bring it back because the interesting thing about the thing that connects the Tree of Life, and you may ask me why I went off on Arcadia for a second, off of the Tree of Life, is the one thing that connects the two is the Bruton Church, in Virginia, and it seems like that's the connect point for a lot of these different maps, as you pointed out before, and that's really where that spiritual treasure was located, the one that we keep talking about. And I want to ask you this: is that really the point in a lot of these different maps? Do you find that that's the center of a lot of these different maps that you're finding?
I believe it is. The spiritual side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. But I think the silver and gold, I think even the silver and gold serves as also a symbol. Everything in this seems to be symbolic, and it ties in with the Tree of Life in a lot of ways, in so many different ways. Like the veil between the celestial and the terrestrial. I think it's everything. Well, you know, you can take like spiritual knowledge or documents and information, which I believe some of these contain. Also, you know, and so did Marie Bauer Hall. They tie together, and I think it's like a symbolic of, and I'm starting to get tongue tied. Mm-hmm. It's symbolic of points on the Tree of Life, and also the difference between, you know, the our reality and the spiritual. And I feel like I'm rambling on that, but I always worry that I'm not explaining myself good. I do think it's symbolic of it.
There was an attempted excavation of treasure at Bruton Church, correct?
Yes. They attempted, Marie Bauer Hall was attempting to locate the vault beneath the cemetery, and that was put to a stop real quick. They didn't, and they denied her permission to continue excavating. And so they never located the contents of the vault.
Now, how did they pacify her at that point, after trying to dig up this vault?
I don't remember how they pacified her, really. That's a good question. I didn't even think of that. For some reason, that slipped. I know I've read the book and a lot of the information about that, but I can't recall how they pacified her.
That's interesting as well. Tell me how Francis Bacon ties into all this in this story.
Yeah. Well, the first clue I had for that was Marie Bauer Hall's book, Foundations Unearthed. And, you know, when I wanted to know who put this there, who put the treasures where they are, why did they do it, how they did it, you know, all the, you know, who, what, why, when, and where. But I wanted to trace it back as far as I could. And, you know, I've working with Jesse, you do a lot of genealogy, so you're, you know, tracing your family tree. And I thought, well, I'll approach this the same way we've approached, you know, our family history. So I started trying to make a, you know, any name that I came across, it would have to have a, or any name, anybody I suspected, it would have to have some kind of verifiable connection. And I connect, you know, Jesse was with Freemasonry, and then it goes past to Albert Pike was a Freemason, very, very popular and famous Freemason. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, from him, you go back to some of the founding fathers who were Freemasons. And that led me to, you know, like, well, and also in dealing with the Bruton Vault, that ties in with William and Mary College, and that which one of the buildings is called the Wren Building, named after Sir Christopher Wren, who was also a Freemason, and he was a fellow of the Royal Society. And, you know, there's all these different people who connected. They tied, you know, back to the founding fathers, beyond them to colonial times, and back to the England, the UK, and it eventually I tied names back, and they all had verifiable connections to Francis Bacon. And when I found that, I thought, ah, this is the guy who did it all. You know, especially after reading all of his accomplishments and everything, and the New Atlantis that he wrote, a book that he wrote. It seems to be the perfect blueprint or template for what America was supposed to be. And I thought, this is amazing. That's the guy who started it all. And I was satisfied for a short time. And then I would go back and read more about him. And I'd notice other connections with other people, like his mentor, John Dee, who was also, he was a spy, an alchemist. He was a genius in his own right. Those guys always amazed me at how smart they were and how well-versed they were in so many numerous topics. And John Dee was, like, for example, he was known as the original 007. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought, okay, if it goes back to John Dee, was there anybody before him? And it just led me on a path, and it's mind-boggling trying to take it all in at once. But over the years, you know, researching, it went from John Dee further back to guys like different rabbis, alchemists, Rosicrucians, and the rabbi. Well, that leads me back. I'm starting to get off track real quick. Sorry about that.
No, you're fine.
From John Dee, mm-hmm. He was a student of a man named John Ahiropoulos. And I'm sorry, it wasn't John Dee. John Dee had a friend whose father was Leonardo da Vinci, and Leonardo da Vinci was a student of John Ahiropoulos. And they had also, there was a famous Renaissance humanist named Johann Reuchlin, who, I don't know if Johann was tied in with that, but, you know, that was just one of the names. For some reason, that name keeps popping out to me, and I don't know why. When that happens, I usually want to keep them fresh in my mind, because there may be something with him.
Right.
But to make a long story short, it ties back through different people, Johann Reuchlin, John Ahiropoulos, back to Maximilian I. And the reason I tied his name in was mainly because there was his physician was a man by the name of Paolo Riccio. And Paolo Riccio was a Jewish convert to Christianity. And back in those days, I don't know if he willingly converted or if he didn't have a choice, you know, convert or die kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, but he had translated the writings of an earlier rabbi by the name of Abraham Gicatilla. He had translated his writings into English and published the book in 1516. Well, on the cover of his book, it has the drawing of a man who appear, I assume the man is, he fit the, you know, researching this a lot, you come across terms like the traveling Jew, and also travelers in other contexts. And I think the man sitting there, and it's just my theory, he's probably very likely Abraham Gicatilla. He was dressed for travel. He was holding a tree of life in one hand. He was pointing at the floor with another hand. And I thought, what's he pointing at? That seems odd that he would just be pointing at the floor. Well, that's when I lined up a world map from 1524, roughly that, within 9 years of the, or actually 8 years of the book being published. And I wanted to see, for some reason, it looked like a map. It looked like an ocean with ripples in the water and the boundaries of different land masses. So I laid the map over the cover, and it matches the North America, the coastline of North America, Central America, and the northern part of South America. And that blew my mind. But that wasn't the biggest thing I found on the cover of that book. The chair that the man is sitting in looked like it's in the shape of the hooked X that Scott Walter has mentioned and done so much work on.
Okay.
Well, and I remember Scott Walter tying that back into the Knights Templar, mm-hmm. Connections with that. So I thought, wow, could it really go that far back? And I kept tracing it back through different rabbis who were related either by marriage, blood, or they corresponded with each other, or in some cases they were real good friends throughout their life. And they all had the same pattern of belief, and they tied back to a famous rabbi who went by the name of Rashi. And I found out about Rashi first from an interview with Timothy Hogan, the Knight Templar Grand Master, and that Rashi was the favored court guest of Hugh, the Count of Champagne, who was one of the founders of the Knights Templar. And now I need to take a breath. I feel like I just ran out of
go,
air.
go ahead, take a breath. So let me summarize. Is it your belief then that Francis Bacon basically was the architect of the New World or New America? He set up America as his New Atlantis, and basically sent the Templar forward into America or the New World as his foot soldier, so to speak. And you think that maybe he put this treasure in America as kind of a bank?
I think that could be very likely. I believe that he it wasn't all done on his own. I think there were other like-minded people that he associated with. They kept this secret. All these different groups that I just mentioned, they had all at one time or another, the Templar, Jewish people, anybody who didn't have the same beliefs as the ruling power at the time, the Catholic Church and others, they stood the chance of losing their life just for making a scientific discovery or saying the wrong thing. So I think it was the goal of all these groups to have a place where they could coexist freely with liberty and freedom. And I think Francis Bacon deserves the credit for writing that down and helping to put it into action. I think it's just my theory, but I think there were others around him that were involved in it, and they all deserve credit. But some of them I can't name for certain, so I just stuck with Francis Bacon because he tied in, and there's a verifiable record of his connections with different people.
Interesting indeed. So that begs the question now. You've put these different templates together, and you have these different maps that you've used, and you've mapped out. And again, I encourage our audience to pick up the book to see these different maps you've even put in the book, although I'm not going to spoil anything, you've even put some locations in the book of where you could potentially find some of this treasure.
That's true.
And I'm not going to have you spoil it either, Dan. I'm going to stop you short of telling your audience where some of this treasure is. I'm going to ask you, have you ever found treasure off your own maps?
I've found where it was, and I've found locations that I believe they still are. Mm-hmm. Everything I used, metal detectors, I even used ground penetrating radar in a couple of places, but I believe it exists, and I am certain that the ones that haven't been recovered may still be there. And I know for sure, definitely, of treasure sites that were recovered. So, I've found it, and it's located some. I just as I mentioned, I think these are too great for me. You know, when I first started this, I thought, wow, Jesse James Gold. Maybe I'll find a quart, a mason jar or something with a couple of coins in it, or an old saddlebag with a few silver coins or something. Mm-hmm. And I stumbled onto this. And over all the years of research, I was glad it made me I feel lucky and glad that I didn't know it all at once, because all the research, and like I'd mentioned about, you know, they did this to help form a free nation, and treasures that also contain, you know, or possible spiritual or treasures of spiritual significance. It's not for me. I don't think it's for me. I think it belongs to the people who put it there.
Now, that brings up an interesting point. Now, you do bring this up in the book, and I guess I'll throw it at you again. You say it's not for you, and maybe it belongs to the people who put it there. For all the years that have passed, for all the years that treasure has sat there, do you have an idea or have a theory as to who that treasure does belong to? And do you think those people know that it belongs to them? And do you think people are actively using that treasure today?
I think that's a real good question. I think it's the Freemasons, and my theory is that it's, you know, the Freemasons put it there. It belongs to them, and the Masonic Templar. I also think they know about it, which is another reason. You know, when I found all this out, I thought, you know, I don't want to cause any trouble off the, you know, right off the bat, but I also, you know, it's too important for me. But at the same time, to answer your question, yeah, I believe they know it's there. I didn't know it at the time. That was a confusing one for me, because I even had the same questions and still sometimes do. Do they know about all of them? Will this help them? I didn't put anything, you know, I didn't want to write anything that would cause trouble for them, for sure, because I've always looked up to Freemasonry. John Wayne was a Freemason. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different thoughts that go into that, but yeah, I believe it was the Freemasons, the Masonic Templar, and I do think some of them know where they are located today.
Okay. Let me go a step further. Do you think that had you stumbled onto something significant, or if you had and put it in print, that somebody would approach and say, hey, you might have gone a little bit too far with this?
That if I had done that, I would hope somebody would have approached me and let me know, you know, you need to give it back. Well, now you've got me tongue tied. I would have hoped that somebody would have approached me, mm-hmm. and, you know, and just asked for it back. You know, this is ours. I wouldn't have wanted to cause any trouble for anybody. That's for sure.
Understandable. And I guess I'll close with this. In the book, you do mention that your mother, for a long time, even up to the point of her death, was fighting to establish that J.L. Courtney was the true Jesse James, and that fight wasn't going to die with her, and that there was still some fighting left to do. What do you feel was left to do to establish that Jesse James was indeed J.L. Courtney?
She had gotten death threats from different people involved with, you know, with ties linking back to the different groups around the James Farm and Museum. Mm-hmm. That of course, when somebody sends your mother a death threat, that made me furious.
Oh yeah.
That, and then they just kept, anytime you would, she went about this as, she was a very honest lady. She would, you know, she never lied. She was always, people described her as honest to a fault. You know, and I know firsthand, if you asked her a question and she gave you the answer, if it made you mad, she'd tell you, don't ask me a question then. So she would just come out and tell you the answer. So, you know, like, do I look fat? Yes. You know, there's no sugar coating around it. Yes, you look fat. But yeah, she put everything into it. She has more evidence. She amassed more evidence that our story is true, then the James Farman Museum has that, you know, their story is true. She's got more evidence than they do, and she backed it up with highly qualified experts in every step of the way. Instead of keeping open-minded, they would just offer as much resistance as they possibly could. So that made me angry. It also, you know, just the passion for finding the truth also led me. At first, it was a mixture of anger and the need for truth. I've gotten past the anger part. That kind of stuff is always a distraction. So I just want to go after the truth and prove this one way or the other once and for all. What, and the last step is DNA, and we're working on that now.
What do you feel needs to be done to kind of button it up and nail it down?
I think DNA, we've got all the other proof, all the records, the photographs, the diary, his signature saying, you know, signing J. James. Mm-hmm. The only other proof that I can think of is DNA. And we're, you know, the doctor we're working with has laid out a map basically that we need to follow so that all our, you know, I's are dotted and T's are crossed if it comes to a big court battle. So,
all right. Name of the book is Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, Secret Diaries, Coded Maps, and the Knights of the Golden Circle. The link is in the description of this show. You can pick it up right now. Daniel Duke, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm very honored.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. Appreciate you joining us today. Folks, that's going to do it for today's edition of Beyond the Darkness. Dave will join us again next Saturday. And again, join him Monday through Friday for Midnight in the Desert and on a TV near you in October. Again, check out his social media to find out more details. Go to darknessradio.com and check out the details on his social media. Click on the links under his bio. And get the details on what's going on with Dave on television. I'm telling you, it's exciting news. I don't want to spoil it for you, but, you know, it's not my news to tell. It's exciting news, folks. You got to want to find it out for yourself. I know I'm excited, and I'm looking forward to seeing Dave this fall on television. Have a good weekend, folks, the rest of your weekend. Appreciate you joining us this weekend on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited, no purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.